I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Stephen Jones, a.k.a. Baby Bird. And you'll be interested to know, we don't really talk about that song. There's so much more in Stephen's back catalogue, and we talk about not just his music and the reissue of the record Ugly Beautiful, which obviously features Gorgeous, as well as the incredible Goodnight, amongst so many others. But I chose to not really kind of go in on that track because I know that he's obviously been asked about that a lot, and I'm very aware of the amount of music that Stephen's made over the years. So I thought there was way more to talk about. And there was, and it's all coming your way very soon. But before we get to that, a quick few thank yous. Big thanks to you lot for listening and supporting this podcast. We're well over 500 episodes now, and we ain't slowing down. Secondly, I'd like to thank the team at the Blue Murder Club podcast. It's a fantastic true crime podcast, and the team over there produce these episodes. And lastly, I'd like to thank my homie, Mr. Scroobius Pip, the guy that got me into podcasting and the guy that owns the Distraction Pieces Network, which this podcast is very proud to be part of. I'm in good company over there. There's some fantastic pods over there that I wish I was as good as them at. And so go check out Films to be Buried with Brett Goldstein. It's a wonderful podcast. And obviously, go and check out Distraction Pieces from the podfather himself, Mr. Scroobius Pip. As I mentioned, there's over 500 of these episodes. So if you've come here for the first time, you're very late to the party. But that's fine. It's a really welcoming place. And so what that does mean is you've missed stacks of episodes. But that's fine. You can go and listen to them all for free when you get to the end of today's episode with Stephen. You can listen to my chats with the likes of Blur, Suede, Foo Fighters. Who else? Let me think. I've got a little list in front of me of names that I don't normally mention when I'm doing this bit. Gary Kemp of Spandau Ballet. Dave Kenin of The Killers. Richie Ramone, Charlene Spiteri. Who else have I got on this little list here? Oh, there's loads. I'd completely forgot I'd even interviewed. I've been doing this for so bloody long now. Allo Black, David Gray. Judas Priest, UB40. I think we touched on UB40 on this episode. But like I say, there's 500 with all your favourite musicians, comedians, DJs, producers, and actors. Go get stuck in at the end of this episode, and why not subscribe while you're over there? And if you do the social media thing, then please give us a follow, a little like, a love, a share, a retweet, you know, whatever it takes. Or just go old school, nudge your mate and tell him about this lispy guy from Essex that talks to wonderful people about records. And if you're feeling really, really generous and you can spare $1 a month, you can become a Patreon. And for that $1, you get access to hundreds of never released episodes. You get to attend a monthly live show on Zoom where you get to feature on an episode as well and hang out with lots of other people that love talking about records and you know, the music that was important in your formative years and your first gigs and stuff like that. We change the topic each month, and it's a lovely little hangout. It's not a sort of muso wanky thing. It's just a really lovely bunch of people. So we'd love more of you to come along. And you get access to an archive of lots of radio shows I've done and mixtapes and all sorts of stuff. And you can get all of that for I think it's about 70-odd p a month. So it's a dollar a month. And you can find that at Patreon, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. Other than that, you can find out about the archives of this podcast, merch and the Patreon and links to all sorts of stuff at your one-stop shop. And it's a simple one-page website. And so go over there and have a little look. And that gives you links to anything you need to know about this pod. And that address is Off the Beat and, it's beat and, not beaten, Off the Beat and Track podcast.com. Okay, that's all that bit done there, so we can get to the good stuff now. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beat and Track podcast with Baby Bird.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Stephen, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, fitting well, I think.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I appreciate your time today, mate.
Pleasure.
I'm going to get you to kick off today's playlist, mate, with the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, it's extremely difficult, but the one that came to mind, which is probably not expected, is Fight the Power, Public Enemy. I think the first time I heard that, and particularly in the Spike Lee movie, I think it's one of those massively powerful things with him when he's walking along with the boombox, and I think it's just, that's the one that I immediately went to, even though there's probably guitar riffs and blah blah blah, but it's just talking at the beginning, and it's fantastic.
Stephen, I can't thank you enough for picking this, mate.
Oh, cool.
On episode 100 of this, I got my mate to interview me about what my picks would be.
Yeah.
And I chose Fight the Power.
Brilliant.
Purely because of Rosie Perez dancing at the beginning of Do the Right Thing as well. And no one ever leans on hip-hop for this. Everybody goes for these huge kind of either like sort of long drawn out sort of Floyd type intros, or some people just go Beatles, Help, you know, bang straight in, and it's like hip hop's got so many instantly incredible intros that then breaks and beats, and obviously the big speech at the beginning of Fight the Power before it drops. Oh mate, I'm so glad you chose that, because like, you're the first person to choose hip hop, and there's over 500 of these now, mate.
Oh god, yeah, absolutely. it's really funny on another thing with like intros for stuff. I remember when I was first doing demos on cassettes and being told by people in the business and people that worked in the lead mill, actually, was my manager in Sheffield. And he said the people just listen to music companies. They just listen to the first 2 seconds and that's it. It's in the bin. It's on the, you know, it won't get put on the slush pile or, you know, the pile that they would actually reconsider. So that's always in my head as well. But I mean, you know, that does it in two seconds as well. So
It's weird what you just said there as well, because I think, again, you know, when you were sending them demos, I was doing exactly the same, and I had that kind of heads up as well. And in the end, I'll put this like little cassette in a fucking great big box and send it anything to try and get to the top of this pile. Well, look, on intros, Stephen, when you was first making music, the way that people would generally listen to it would have been, I guess, you know, the goal would have been to have got on radio and to have, you know, to got out and release records and CDs, and now it's so much different in the way that so many people consume music via things like Spotify, where it's awash and flooded with so much music. And I'm watching the way that my children consume their music now, where they'll get music from things like TikTok and things like that, where their thumbs are like so quick. And how much of like the sort of movements in music and the fact that, you know, I guess with commercial pop records now, it's becoming like this 2-minute science of like, you know, we've only got their attention for this and we need to get on this Spotify place. So it's got to be like start with the chorus and all of these kind of cheats that isn't almost a, you know, a science to it. And how many of these sort of changes and you know, and places where people consume the music, how much of that filters through into your creative process now, if at all?
Well, I'm the same with my kids. My kids are exactly the same. So it's the you know, the thumbs that are whizzing and down the glass. It's like, it's no, I just think it's weird that people don't pay for music. So, you know, you have these YouTube subscriptions and all these things, but they just watch it and they don't pay for anything. And TikTok's a good example. But TikTok is kind of like the 20-second clip, isn't it?
Mm.
Which, you know, on top of some crap, basically.
Yeah.
But I've heard a lot of things on TikTok. There's a lot of hip hoppy stuff on TikTok that's used, and I'll suddenly Shazam it, and then I'll be listening to that. So I do. There are good experiences on that. But it's probably not answering your question. But I think I do the same thing, and I'm of a certain age where I can't preach to, you know, how kids should listen to music. That's just the way it is. They don't buy music anymore. I think maybe indie kids might go into record stores and buy vinyl and stuff. Yeah. But obviously that happens. But I always used to thumb through the NME or Sounds or Melody Maker, and I would look for a song that, or a band and read about them. I do the same thing on iTunes and probably even Amazon and different places. You know, I look, even though all the things on the front page have been put up by record companies, so they've been, you know, it's money and they've been put on the front page. But I'll go a bit deeper than that. I'll look in alternative, I'll look in classic, anything. I'll look, and that's still hasn't changed. I'm just doing it on a screen. I'm not doing it in a newspaper, which is sad, but it's also kind of like the way I find music.
And we're going to talk today also, there's a reissue of Ugly Beautiful coming soon.
Yeah.
So when you was writing that, would the goal have been to get on Peel, to get on the Evening Session and to try and sort of get through that kind of thing, and would that factor into how you'd write?
I think at that point I started off by doing, I did 5 lo-fi albums, and we released them in a year, so they were all on cassettes, and there were 400 originally, and I took enough to put on 5. So we had 2 years of flogging that round record companies before we got any interest. So I think suddenly when that kind of formed a band, and then we went on to do Ugly Beautiful. But I think that's when it kicks in, that you suddenly realize, well, other people, your record company, are gearing you towards, you know, doing sessions and stuff. And we did Mark Radcliffe and Lard and all these people, and Mark Lamar even. So that's something that just becomes part of the machine. You do it, and then luckily we enjoyed all those. We if that makes sense, we loved doing those sessions. Being in a room with Mark and Lard and sort of with a drummer in the corner and just having a laugh. It was fantastic. So that was a real pleasure. But that again is something that's organized for you. But before I was doing albums, which I did myself and led on to this.
I know, if I'm right, that it was originally recorded prior to the record, but am I right in saying, cause it was my introduction to you. I've DJed in an alternative club for the last 30 years, Stephen. And the first seven I got yours was Goodnight. And was that the lead single from the record?
That was the one. I mean, I just love that song.
It's an absolute gem of a pop record, mate.
Yeah, I think just the words in that, you know, the it's fantastic. Yeah, no, I'm very proud of that, and I'm really glad that Your Gorgeous was not the first single, because I mean, again, everything that went after that was, you know, you're trying to, the record companies were trying to chase that. They wanted to repeat that. But Goodnight was the Mark and Lard thing. That's where we'd be in the studio for the first time. And I'd never experienced that in my life. So it was that's the one I remember, that first one.
Yeah. Was that chosen as a lead single because it's such a cracking little pop gem?
I think, and it was also on those first 5 albums in a different form.
Yeah.
So I think... record company again, you know, it was a joint thing with the record company. It was good. We were never told what to do, but it felt like it was a good leap from my little lo-fi recordings into Goodnight, and it's great, and it's under 3 minutes, I think, well, roughly around 3 minutes, so it's a classic kind of pop song thing.
I'm going to ask you for track 2, please, to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Well, I mean, there's going to be thousands, but it's just immediately what came to me directly was Ghost Town by The Specials, I think. And I think I actually knew Terry Hall a bit. I'd met him in various places in Manchester, and we always planned that we would do something at some point, because he has a connection with Ian Brody as well, who I think they've written together, and I've written a few songs with Ian. So And just obviously what's happened, you know, it's terrible. He popped up on my Facebook the other day, and just with my dad who's died recently, and it's all these people have come up, and it's that's kind of maybe what the thing about Ghost Town. And Ghost Town again, the video and everything, the kind of bleakness and to have songs like that in the charts is what's needed. Give a balance.
And I imagine at quite a young age you would have been when Ghost Town come out.
Yeah.
Like, was you aware, you know, we look back now on documentaries around, you know, the late 70s and early 80s, and it's so apparent how fucking bleak everything was.
Yeah.
Was you aware of that at that time? Did that music soundtrack what you could see?
Well, I hadn't been to Coventry at that point, but I did go to Coventry once, and it's bleak.
I'm going tomorrow, bizarrely.
Are you going? we had a really bizarre meeting because we got signed by Atlantic in America, and they decided they wanted to come and see us in Coventry. So it's quite high out there for all these wanky Americans. I kind of lived near Derby, so I used to go in on with my friend Ralph. We used to cycle in and go and see the UK subs, and Antipasti was the local Derby, and Joy Division, of course. So,
yeah.
So I knew what it was like. Derby's was bleak. I don't know what it's like now, but I certainly was fully aware of. And then the bleak vision of Joy Division, which is my main into music.
Yeah.
So it's all there, and it's kind of like. But the Specials were such a happy band, and it was multicultural, and the whole thing was quite brilliant. And I took my sister when she was 15 or something. I took her to see when the Specials, Selector, and Madness were on.
What, and the two-tone tour?
It was brilliant. So touring bleakness, it was very kind of sort of on the verge of violence.
Yeah.
There, my sister reminded me that I buggered off with my friend and left her there as a 15-year-old for periods of time. So I feel bad about that. But yeah, it was quite scary. I think that was before they started having hits. But you can see where it was all coming from.
And it was such a statement as well. It was like I was a little while ago. I got to interview Robin from UB40, and I was looking at you look at that. Point of the early, like late 70s, early 80s, and UB40, them records at that point, and the Specials, like that was probably the first time I'd ever seen multicultured bands on Top of the Pops and things like that. It was quite a statement, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. UB40 is a good example of. I don't think if you know the whole history of UB40, I think a lot of people say, "Oh, Red Red Wine," and it's very popular, but it wasn't. They was kind of same kind of background as. You know, all the Specials and all the Scar stuff. So, yeah, no, totally agree.
And he said that as well. He said that Jerry Dammers offered him a deal. And
right, okay.
And he said, look, as much as we love that label, we wanted to be a reggae band. We didn't want to be a ska band. And so we politely sort of turned that down. But I mean, going back to Ghost Town and the question around it, if you had to sort of pinpoint the emotion, what would it have been?
The emotion I had?
Yeah.
I think it's music that I would never dare to make because, normal English. I don't know. It's just something that I could never do. And it's a bit like hip-hop. I could never do hip-hop, but it's that's... I like that. That's why I like that kind of music. I don't really like music that sounds like Baby Bird. That makes sense. I wouldn't listen to similar stuff that we make. Even though there's a big range of styles now with what I do, but I just think Terry Hall was a beautiful man, and I think is it Neville and the other guy? There was just something infectious and very, very innocent. And I think Terry Hall was like a little boy, like a baby almost, and singing these songs. And I think that was my feeling. I just remember the tunnel. I'm sure there was a tunnel in the video.
It is, yeah.
And I think that's that kind of really. I'd been in a lot of tunnels like that in Derby. I brought it back.
I think the joy in that record as well is, I mean, sonically, if that's for a bit of a wanky description of it, it's otherworldly, that record, isn't it? It don't sound like any other Special song either. It's just out there on its own, and it's so somber, and then you're just waiting for that moment where it just rockets, doesn't it? And it's a pure joy when it goes as well. And the fact Terry nearly cracks a smile in that video as well. It's like wonderful.
I think it's the movement, and when they do it live, just the back and forward. I don't know. It's just like an engine, and I think that's what was so brilliant about seeing them as well doing everything else. And it was, you know, Madness had their thing, which and Selector, and then it was very, very particular, really good.
And I think one of the things that jumped at me as a young lad as well, watching the likes of Specials, Madness, UB40 at that point, them three bands, they looked like a fucking gang. They all looked like they were a gang. And I love that in bands, when you see them and you just think, they all look like...
Yeah, that's the whole point, isn't it? That's why you want to be in bands. It's a gang, It's like football. It's a gang, it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask you for track three, please, Stephen. Tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yeah, well, it's probably showing my age now, but definitely Joy Division. Touched on it before, but Joy Division were my... I'm old, but I was too young to kind of hit punk at a certain point, which is a real pity. You know, the Clash and the Pistols and all that, I kind of missed that. But I was more sort of 79, 80, and it was sort of Stranglers' first album, when the Stranglers were amazing. And then Joy Division, just the I played a lot of bass. I mean, I played guitar as well, but because of Peter Hook, made the bass melodic.
Yeah.
I suddenly thought, right, I can actually make some songs with a bass.
Yeah.
And I did. and did with shitty bands, you know. But just again, that was... which is the one? Isolation's the one that might not have been... That was later, I know, but Isolation's the song that I...
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Always go to with Joy Division. It's weird because you listen back to Joy Division now and some of it is very hard to listen to. It was very much of the time. It's very, a lot of it's quite mechanical as well, which you don't remember, sort of the way the drums, maybe that's on the second album. But yeah, that was the thing I remember, just kind of school time, yeah.
And you said, was it Derby that you grew up in?
Yeah, well, I saw the last gig, Ian Curtis's last gig, I think was in Derby, and I managed to find a recording of it. Sort of a bootleg recording of it. It's brilliant. So that you can hear the clapping. I just wonder, is one of those people clapping me, you know?
Oh, you were at the show as well?
Yeah. Oh, I was fantastic. At the show. And again, petrifying. It was a bit like before the Scar thing got rid of the skinhead element, which started. The Joy Division was the same in Derby. There were the Spondon, which is near Derby. They'd be up in, it was an old Indian cinema. And so it was like on the top, there were skinheads from one part of Derby and another down there. So they were pulling up chairs. And me and my friend Ralph were hiding in the corner trying to watch Ian Curtis do his thing. But I think that was the last gig or the one before the last one that they ever did. So, yeah, quite a big event in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And home in Derby in those early years, was it musical? Was there records on at home?
What do you mean? What was I listening to?
No. Like growing up was like, you know, was your parents into music? Was it a musical place to grow up?
No, not really. I lived in my earliest memories. I lived in New Zealand. I was taken to New Zealand when I was four, and my sister was only 18 months, but we went on a boat, which you could do back then. So
to New Zealand?
We went to New Zealand. So we because for 50 quid, if you were a teacher and you had a job in New Zealand, you could take your family over there. So we were on a boat for a month. We travelled one way through the Suez Canal and Tahiti and Sri Lanka. I can't remember because I was so young. And then 4 years later, we came back the other way through the Panama Canal. So I've circumferenced the world, but I don't remember it. It's not me, really. It's something I don't remember. But my mum and dad just used to listen to Rolf Harris before Rolf became, such a... or whatever, but like Timing Kangaroo Down, we had an old reel-to-reel and they used to play stuff like that, and then we would listen to Maori folk songs and stuff, but that's my real memory. And then getting a bit older, I would probably Bay City Rollers, which again is another dodgy.
Yeah.
that's weird. But yeah, it's weird. I don't know if you're watching the Steve Coogan thing.
Yes, yeah.
The Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, I finished
I'm
it
trying
last
to make
night.
A link there, but it seems like Rolf Harris, the Bay City Rollers, and we did Top of the Pops once, and I always wonder if I was in a dressing room that Jimmy Savile had been in. So that's I've never thought of it like that. It's three very, very dodgy touch points there.
You've just mentioned the Pops there, and I'm always fascinated to ask guests about their experience at Top of the Pops, because as I'm sure it was the case for you, we'd grow up and, every Thursday you'd watch the Pops, and it was, it was the only place you could see your pop stars, and it was so exciting. And in my mind, I thought if they're on Top of the Pops, they're all rich beyond their wildest dreams, going back their, their mansions afterwards. Like, can you remember hearing you was going to, you got the green light to go on Top of the Pops, and then when you'd done it, was it what you imagined? Did it deliver?
No, not really. No, I remember they had a good load of pool tables backstage. That's where we had most of our fun. But no, it's weird because it's three. That's why I was talking about the Steve Coogan, Jimmy Savile thing, because I think you can see there it's three stages and a group of hardly any people, but it was made filmed so it looked like a load of people, and they were shifted around each stage. So, but you're stood there. I think we did it three times. So I mimed on most of them, but I did actually sing live. So the miming business is just bizarre.
Mm.
It's just a weird thing. To sing live is so much easier, but to have to mime, I just, like when your voice is out, when your mouth is out of, I just can't mime. It's one of those things I can't do. So I'll be, when there's a silence, I'll still be moving my mouth because I'm so confused. It must be some mental condition I have. But yeah, so weird. It's weird. I think all these things are always built up, and I think Top of the Pops obviously has got such a big history. I think when you go on, you think, it's not quite like it was on the TV.
But, yeah.
Can you remember who I wouldn't swap it for anything,
Yeah. Can you remember who you was on with? Can you remember who else, was that one of the sort of first times you sort of wandering around in those circles and going, blimey, that's him over there or that's her over there? Like, can you remember any of those moments?
Well, I'm sorry if I'm name dropping, but when we were in our dressing room, we had an attack from all five Spice Girls. They came in and just dancing around, full of life, amazing, really. I'll always remember it.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend, now wife, was there, so she got to experience it as well. And Mel B was very chatty, and she would talk straight to you. And it's like they came in like a whirlwind, and then they were off.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably the most famous. I don't remember anyone else that was on it, to be honest. Gina G or someone like that. But you'll always remember the Spice Girls. Whatever you think of their music, they were a phenomenon for that period.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just moving back to school, was that an experience you enjoyed?
No, I was kind of bullied at school. I was kind of like, I went to a school where my dad was a teacher, and I got the nickname of Dingo because I'd been to New Zealand. I get called Dingo, and there are no dingoes in New Zealand. That's the irony. They're in Australia. But I couldn't really say that to the bully particularly. Yeah. I think it's General Haig. You remember General Haig was in the it was his grandson.
Yeah,
he was in World War II, I think. But his grandson was like a a nasty, nasty bully. So it was when I got into the sixth form, I kind of like exploded. Like I was saying, my friend Ralph, we went off to this cinema in Derby and we went to see all the punk, the post-punk bands, Cockney Rejects, UK Subs, all these people. And it was Throbbing Gristle was another one. It's like all these out mad bands. So I think it was great that I'd been through that kind of. I'm not damaged by bullying. I mean, it was just a horrible period, and I don't remember it that much. But I just remember the sixth form being an explosion of excitement, and but not because of school, but because of punk.
I think sixth form's where you kind of, because you don't have to go there. That's generally where you sort of find your tribe, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, it was brilliant. Everything about it was a joy.
Yeah. Did you know what you wanted to do at that point?
Just for Joy Division, probably music. But again, I was playing the bass really badly, so it wasn't. And we would go and play with my friends. But it was kind of when I left school that I suddenly I started doing music with Ugly Beautiful and all the stuff that I've done very, very late in my late 20s. So it was never something I thought I could do until people. I'm the kind of person that needs to be told, you know, oh, this song's all right. You could go and do something with that. I need to kick up the arse. So that's always been the way. So I don't think when I came out of school, I had any idea what I would do.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was on the dole for a long time. I was on the dole for like five, 6 years. So, you know, living on whatever that was and stealing 50p out the gas meter and putting them back in again. And no, so I've been through all that. So I think that pushes you to do stuff. And that made me buy a little cassette recorder and start doing music. So I think from adversity, you get a kick up the backside, which is good.
Once you started kind of getting people sort of, you know, leaning over your shoulder and saying that tune's really good. And you know, from what I know about you, you're pretty prolific with your output.
Like,
did that create drive? Like, I wonder because, you know, we're sitting here however many years later talking about, you know, the reissue and you've released so much music, you know, over the years. Like, are you pretty driven?
No, people would say I was lazy, but I think it's not something I think about. I think there's a lot of things I hate doing, you know. I don't like mowing the lawn. Stuff that I just, everyday stuff I don't like. But when it comes to music, my dad always had a piano in the front room. And he never pushed us towards it, but I gravitated towards it. So I've never been pushed in that way, but it's just, if it's there, then I do it. But I don't think I'm driven. I just love doing it. It's a hobby. Yeah. You know, it's not work. So does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think I'm not driven. I think you see so many people who are driven, and it's like, I don't know, it could be anyone who seems to be doing stuff all the time. Like Michael Palin seems to be, or Michael Palin or Stephen Fry, I don't know any of these people, or people that tour, U2, anyone, you know, they're away for months and months. I've never done that. So they seem to want to fill every little space with doing stuff.
Yeah.
But now I'm kind of a bit older, long in the tooth. I kind of just like to sit there and do nothing, and then I'll have bursts of making music.
Yeah.
But again, that's not, I'm not being driven, I don't think. I think I'm just like, I love doing it.
Yeah. Tell me about the first record you remember buying from a record shop, please.
Oh, yes. Let me just... oh, God, yeah, that was... Well, one of the first was Nevermind the Bollocks. So I think that was... Probably because I just missed out on when, you know, 76 and 77. And obviously with the Clash's first record, that was a big one as well. But my sister had that, oddly, and she was like much younger than me. I keep listening. It's one of those things that I do keep listening to now because the production on it, without being boring and musical, is like incredible. It's just, it stands up to now, just the sound of the guitars, everything is just stunning. And I always say when we're rehearsing to go on tour, let's try and make every song sound as crisp as this and powerful. Yeah. So I think that was the first record. I can't really remember any singles. I used to buy singles, but it was normally LPs I'd buy. So, I mean, God Save the Queen, if you were to pick a track, would be the one that I would you know, I would put on. And yeah, yeah.
It's so weird, isn't it? When you look back at, like, you mentioned some of the sort of, you mentioned like Cockney Rejects and you know, the UK Subs and the bands from back then, and, you know, and so many bands that come out of punk and was, you know, come out around the time of the Pistols, you know, and I don't include the Clash in this, but none of them records or the production around them records still smacks you around the chops like Never Mind the Bollocks. It's so huge and it's so good, that production, isn't it? And I know it's, you know, we're being a bit muso wankery here, but it is just fucking huge, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's astonishing. Yeah. We do, it's probably one of the only bands we actually listen to, or I listen to copy that production. Obviously not the style of songs, but that production. Yeah.
Okay. So, did a were record shops, you know, in them sort of formative years that, you know, that you're talking about there, were they an important place for you?
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm still going to them now. It's like Bury's. I'm in near Manchester, so I go to Bury and they've still got an HMV, and you kind of, your eyes widen when you say, oh my God, it's still open. Yeah. And you're genuinely excited to go in. Things have changed now. There seem to be cops, don't there? And
but there's lots of records
again,
though.
Everything that's not a record. Pardon?
There's lots of vinyl again, though.
That's brilliant. Yeah, but when you go in, you're even like these boat drinks and stuff in the
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
One in Barry. It's really weird. It's like you have to go beyond that to get. But yeah, vinyl. Yeah, vinyl's something I. It's funny, Ugly Beautiful's. It's quite a heavy vinyl. So I've got like my record players are always like dance sets. You know, like old. Yeah. I like old record players. I actually put it on to listen to it, and it broke it. So it kind of like the thing, the turntable bit sank down. So I don't actually have a vinyl player at the moment. Don't have a record player.
Wow.
But so that's quite ironic, isn't it? That this reissue broke. But yeah, I need a record player. I love them.
Is the reissue going to come out on vinyl?
It's on vinyl. Yeah, it's a double.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's a double. But I just vinyl for the last 10 years. I think I've stopped and sold a lot of my records. But just that 20 minutes you get to sit down and do nothing. It can be meditation, whatever. You just sit there and you're not actually getting up to switch stuff on your phone or...
Yeah.
Or Google stuff, or look at all. You know, Shazam is a. I don't really use Shazam because it's insane, but it makes things too easy. But I'd rather put a record on and give myself 20 minutes.
And the one thing, and I'm always sort of mindful of not sounding like a grumpy old man that it was better in my day. But the one thing that I do think is lost in you know. Vinyl sort of disappearing and becoming more of a sort of novelty collector's thing now.
Yeah.
Is his album artwork, and we talk about the pistols there, and you know, that is not going to really do a lot on that little square on your Spotify thing on your phone, is it? But you look at that album on vinyl and that cover, it still knocks your socks off. And I think that's something that I feel is a little bit lost now, is the album artwork.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. Whenever you watch these shows or see magazines about the greatest 100 album covers of whenever, nothing's from the last 15 years.
Yeah. No, I want that desperately, and I don't know how you do it. What's the equivalent now? If you want that artwork, do you put it on a screensaver on your phone?
I don't know.
Do you buy a T-shirt? I don't know. It's. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I've never really engaged that much with CDs. I mean, unless it's a cardboard thing and there's a booklet in there and there's something to read. But I think a lot of bands were responsible for using record company designers in a bland way, and that I think that it was too vague. I think you need some substance, and those are the CDs that I prefer, and albums I prefer with something to actually read on it, not just name checking people.
Absolutely. I'm going to move forward now to your clubbing days, Stephen.
I did have some of those, actually.
Fantastic. Let's talk about them. But I want to know what song soundtracked it.
Yeah, well, I was after I left college, I was in Nottingham. So I was saying I was unemployed for like 5 or 6 years. So it was kind of a guy called Gerald, and Voodoo Ray was the one, really, I think, that stuck out. There was a lot of the kind of acid stuff. What was the first acid song? Not Adamski. I can't remember what it was called. It was like the first time you heard that sound, and it's just kind of predated the 80s a bit. I don't know what it was called.
What was it, like Joey Beltram or something like that?
I can't remember the name of it. No. I need to hunt that out. I've been looking for that song, but I can't remember what it is. But I think Voodoo Ray still sticks out now because of the sounds
incredible.
On it. And that's kind of has a little influence. I like using loops and sounds and odd, strange things. So that just did everything. And it was you could dance to it as well, you know, even though it was a bizarre, different song from anything else you'd heard. I mean, it was a lot of early Talking Heads and Chic and Chaka Khan was sort of around that time. And then to hear that was fantastic.
And where would you go clubbing in Nottingham?
In Nottingham, and we went to again, I can't remember where the bloody hell it was. There's something Cool Cat,
right.
Cool Cat in Nottingham. Oh, it was amazing place. But they had a hip hop room. I went back there a few years, and they had a hip hop room, and I was dancing, and this guy took offence. I found out he was a boxer, but he punched me. So I went to. I've still got the scar on this side here. On the right hand side, because he thought I was taking the piss, and I wasn't. I was just trying to dance as well as I could. But it was mostly black kids in there, so I think maybe, you know, you could be easily seen as taking the piss, and I really, really wasn't, because I love hip hop. So, I ended up in hospital. So that's my memory, apart from that song apart from Uncle Gerald. Yeah.
Did you, I mean, was you lucky enough, you know, being up that way to sort of, you know, you mentioned Manchester a few times and obviously Joy Division. Did you get to the Hacienda at all?
I never got to the Hacienda, no. We were going to do a gig there, really weirdly. So I got to see the Hacienda when it was empty.
Oh, really?
Really, really bizarre. So we actually went and got a tour of the Hacienda. But yeah, no, that was part of a theatre. I was in a theatre company, so we were going to do a show there, and a music show. It's not worth going into, but it was really weird because I'd never been to the Hacienda, I'd never been there as a club night. So I think I was in Nottingham at that point, and obviously the Hacienda's gone now; it's flat. Yeah. So, but my friend Jason used to go there all the time, so I get all the stories of the drugs on the door. There was a lot of security problems and guns and stuff. That's the way it went.
I asked you about Drive earlier, Stephen, and you know, you said that, you know, you went on Top of the Pops three times, and then obviously, you know, you, around that point, you know, you was on every TV show, you was everywhere, all over the music press. Would you say you was a confident young man at that point?
No, not at all. I think it makes you seem arrogant, but I'm really shy. But on stage, I'm a bit of a lunatic, really, and a lot of talking to the audience, and it's a kind of gregarious big thing, but I think that's a cover for shyness. So I'm definitely not. I know that my stuff's good. It will can be good. I would never say it. My dad was always apologetic. He used to do paintings and he was very apologetic. So I learned not to be apologetic for what I do. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. You know, that's that's life, isn't it? But no. So, yeah, if that answers that.
Well, what about, like, you know, seeing, like, you know, I imagine you grew up reading the likes of The Enemy and The Maker and things like that. And all of a sudden these people are probing you for answers and things like that. Like, and having chart success and being on the TV. Like, how did you find that?
Just weird. Like I said, I was shy, but it's a simple rule with me. If I've got a microphone, and I've got lights in my face and I can't see what's going on, then I'm fine. I've written a few books, so I've kind of done stuff is it Borders? And it's gone now. Mm. But I did some book readings and there's no light, so I was just bright red and embarrassed to hell. And I was trying to read my novel and I was reading the wrong words and my eyes were like, I went purple. So, but if you put lights in front of you, whether it's a TV show and it's great. It's like, it blocks out everything and you concentrate on what you're doing. So it's a simple thing for me, really. Put some lights on me and don't show me the mechanics of what's going on behind the camera, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to take you home for this track and ask you to tell me a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Oh, my home county. Well, I couldn't find anything from Shropshire. So I've lived in Manchester like I do now for 10 years. And then I lived in Manchester for a long period before. I lived in London as well. So if I can stretch it to Manchester, I think Container Drivers by the Fall is just epic. I think it's kind of small and but huge, and Marky Smith is fabulous. Now I've been to see in Manchester, he's got a huge mural on the side of a fish and chip shop. So it's and I saw them 7 times, and I've seen gigs that where he would slowly take away, if he was pissed off with the drummer, he would slowly take a cymbal away, carry on with the song, then he would take another part of the drum away. so just marvelous, and you know what a great man. And I was there at the beginning with Totally Wired and all that early stuff, and Elastic Man was it, yeah. And so they were a massive part.
He's everything you want from a pop star, isn't he? It's fantastic. I mean, I've heard some. I think it might have been, was it Mark Riley? Who was in The Fall? Was it Mark Riley?
Mark Riley, yeah.
It
Mark
was,
Riley,
yeah.
Guitar in The Fall for a while, yeah.
And I remember he said a story once about they were touring in Australia, and they were in a nightclub, and him and someone from the band went to this nightclub, and I don't think Mark wanted to be there, but I don't think he wanted them to go and have fun without him.
Right,
and then
yeah.
They were dancing to ABBA. And he just walked on onto the dance floor. It wasn't Riley he punched, but he punched the other guy for dancing to ABBA. the guy flew home the next day and left the band. But I think that was a constant, never-ending rotation.
That's a general rule for anyone concerning ABBA, surely. Bloody hell. I cannot believe that. Is it the hologram show they're doing? It's just unbelievable, but it's so popular.
Absolutely.
They are, along with Queen, ABBA are the antichrist of music.
Do you know what, right? I'm not going with the ABBA thing. I do think they've got some great pop songs, but Queen, I'm with you. I don't get it.
Oh, no. I'll rephrase that. I think the songs are, I think it's the love for...
Right.
With Mamma Mia and the films, it just seems like the lowest common denominator to me. Really, I'm being really patronising, but Yeah, of course they've got great songs, you know, Fernando and Waterloo. I mean, you know, they're good, but it's the idea of it, and I think the people that flock to it.
Yeah.
Listen to them at home, you know, on your own, but don't put it on the TV, please.
It's Mark E. Smith when you need him. Okay, well, this is your last track, Stephen, and this is the opportunity where I ask you to tell our listeners about a song that you think they may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Well, this is something I probably listen to like every other day. It's Lamplighter and Ed Scissor, and it's The Prospector. And it's I don't know if you'll be able to find it, actually. I think it's on YouTube, but it's very, very hard to find. I found it through Bandcamp, but he kind of talk raps through it. Is it like Scrooby? I can never pronounce Scroobius Pip. It's kind of a bit similar to that.
That's quite weird. He's my best friend.
Is he your best friend? I think I might have spoken to him once. I think I wrote to him once. I don't know, through social media probably, but yeah, no, I love his stuff, and this is very, very similar. But right. Obviously, people know about him, but they don't know about Ed Scissor. I think it's Ed Scissortongue as well. But he seems to have a very small following. But it's the perspective. If people can find it, it's got a really lovely piano loop on it.
Yeah.
And words are just like, it makes me shiver now just talking about them. I think it's beautiful, and his voice, his tone of his voice. Like, I always liked Guru off Gangstar, because he's got one of those. It's like an almost creamy voice.
Yeah.
It's something that's in your head. And this guy, this Ed Scissor's like that as well. Lamplighter does a lot of, I think, more sound, more kind of not with vocals on. But
yeah,
it's one of those bands I'd love to know more, but I don't think anyone will have heard them, and I think it should hunt it out.
I found a track by Ed Scissor, but it was, what's the track called again? Sorry?
The Prospector.
There's the Prospector 3.
Oh, it's not that one.
I'm
beginning to think that it was a sample, because I've tried to look for it on the and on the album. I remember it being on, and it's gone. So I just wonder if they got into trouble with sampling.
Ah, right.
But I've got it. So
yeah. apart from that, I'll put that version on. But we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all of the tracks that we've spoken about today. Stephen, and so let's get back to your music and the reissue, and what can people expect from that, and when's it happening, and what else is going to be happening around that?
Well, I haven't done interviews for a long time, because we haven't toured for a while, so it's been nice. There's been a lot of interest, I think, and because it's out, it's album day tomorrow. Is it today it's or today? Is it
14th,
today?
I believe.
14th, right? Yeah, so it's all converging on that. But yeah, there's extra tracks on there as well, and tracks that I knew about and tracks I'd forgotten about. So that's been the biggest pleasure, is getting all the tapes from the studio recordings. And it's weird. There's the people, you know, people are always going to gravitate towards You're Gorgeous, but there's songs on there like Jesus Is My Girlfriend, which caused quite a lot of trouble in the past. Too Handsome to Be Homeless is another one. So there's a lot of gritty stuff on there, which I'm probably lyrically prouder of. And, you know, you've been fantastic not to mention Your Gorgeous. I've brought it up, which is the first. But you listen to the verses on that, and it's completely dark and cuts you to the core, I hope. And if anyone points to you at a wedding and to You're Gorgeous, and lots of people play at their wedding, it's an insult.
Yeah.
You know, if I point at you and go, You're Gorgeous, it's a barb. But people shouldn't be told how to interpret songs, you know. If they love it and it's got that ridiculously catchy tune, on the Marmite song, you know, it's what can I say? It's they should interpret it the way they want.
I mean, it's a fantastic record. I prefer the other version on the flip side, the more synthy one.
Oh, yeah, there's a few versions. Yeah. I prefer all those. there's a country and western acoustic one.
Oh, right, no, I've not heard that.
Makes it really mournful.
Yeah.
So, but I know the one you're talking about. I like that one as well. Yeah, yeah. There's an epic one as well, but there's quite a few versions. And the one, when I put out these first lo-fi albums before Ugly Beautiful, so before anyone knew who Baby Bird was, it was from 400 demos, those albums, and You're Gorgeous was one of those demos, and it never made it onto those. So it was never a choice of mine. It was chosen because of its chorus, I think, and, you know, it did what it was supposed to for the record company.
Fantastic. And new music coming soon? Gigs? What's
happening? I'm on Bandcamp all the time. So you say prolific. If people want to listen to 10,000 songs, That's on my bank account. There's shitloads of stuff.
I can tell you who does. It's Dom Jolly, because he come on this podcast.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
He loves you, mate. He absolutely loves you. He was he could not sing your praises, and he's a very, very big fan. I presume you know that anyway. But
he's we've collaborated on stuff, and I think and Trigger Happy,
of course,
on there. So no, Dom's fantastic. We were supposed to play his 50th birthday.
Yeah.
Thing, but I had a problem. I had a problem with my heart, actually, so I couldn't do it, which is a real pity. But I think there's possibilities of stuff coming up. But he's great. Trigger Happy was wonderful with a big phone in the cinema. I mean,
incredible,
you know, legendary incredible. Bit.
And Stephen, if people want to keep up the speed with all things creative via you, where's the best place to do that?
Well, Bandcamp. So it's the StephenJones.bandcamp.com, but if you put Stephen Jones or Baby Bird or whatever, you'll find it on there. And good luck getting through this. There's a hell of a lot of stuff on there. I use a lot of AKAs, so you know, it's for different types of music I do. Yeah. You know, with vocals, non-vocals. So yeah, but it's just stick a pin in the donkey and see what you come out with.
Fantastic. Stephen, honestly, thanks so much for your time today. It's been a real joy talking records with you, mate.
Thank you.
I'm going to press stop, but don't go anywhere.
Okay.
There you go. Oh, what a delightful chat. And what an absolutely lovely man. And go get that reissue now. It's out now. As he said, double album, Ugly Beautiful reissue with loads of extra material on it. Go check it out. Remind yourself, if you've not listened to that album since back in the day, go back to it, because I had a big old listen today and it's sounding fucking ace. And if you've never heard that record, go do it. It's wonderful. And then why not head over to Bandcamp and check out all of the work that that Stephen's been done. Set yourself aside 6 years and go and listen to everything he's done, because there's loads and it's all ace. I'm back next time. In the meantime, be nice to each other. Thanks ever so much for listening and supporting this podcast. I love doing this. You know, I'm getting to meet all the people that, you know, have shaped my musical taste over the years, and this was very much one of those interviews. So thanks again to Stephen, thanks again to you for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye bye.